The facade of the American dream.
This is a story of a people who had existed and thrived in their land for thousands and thousands of years before they were kidnapped, tortured, chained, raped, and enslaved. This is the African who was stolen from his motherland and civilization and had everything taken from him. His language, his religion, his culture, his family, his identity.
Looking at the so-called African-American experience, there's this state right now where there's great confusion about people. Where do we belong? Who are we? How well are we integrated into the system or culture?
We're not a natural people. We're not a normal people. We're a made people. And we also have an identity problem. We have an identity crisis.
When you begin to use African-American, you're starting to imply that you arrived in the U.S. just like any other and every other immigrant group arrived in the U.S., such as Italian-American. And we begin to negate historically the fact that black folks were largely brought here as chattel.
Above 40 million people died. So when you talk about 40 million people dying, and that's not counting the people who died in Africa as well as the people who died subsequently in the United States and in the West Indies.
That a system would set the descendants of a people who were held captive for 400 years up to fail, it's not too far to understand how that could happen.
The enslavement of African people in North America has ever ended, that it has mutated and taken various forms.
When people talk the enslavement of African people in this country, they talk about the trader, the person who went to Africa and brought the Africans over here. They talk about the owners, the people who purchased them once they got here. They said that was a very important third person involved in the whole thing, and they called that person the slave maker. And this person's job was to take people who had traditions, culture, language, and break them down psychologically.
Our history was not taught. Our languages were not taught. Our families were broken up. The culture in this country has done everything in its power to see to it that we remain subservient.
Previous generations, we were enslaved, which is to be in physical bondage. To be in slavery is to have internalized the process and to manage and to govern oneself according to the ethos and the rules of dominant society or the dominator.
Since those first 20 and some odd indentured servants disembarked from that Dutch man of war in 1619, the predominant American culture and system has done everything to in its power to take that from us.
Most people don't support reparations for black people. Number one, they don't know history. They don't understand the depravity of of slavery and its impact on the African Americans.
If you erase the past and then you don't have a common vision, then you left your victim.
Number two, the leadership has been compromised again, and they don't press for reparations.
There were 10,000 families that held 6 million people enslaved in America. And they could not have done so without the cooperation of what we call house niggers.
If you have to put 20 people, let's say to watch 50 people, that's economically expensive. So what you gotta do is break the people down psychologically, that I dominate you, I control you, so that you can have two people watch 50 people. Then you can make some money.
Okay, so they've always had house niggers. They've always had those people who enroll in their model, in their economic model, for their benefit.
Because whiteness and the superior place of white people over other people required that there be people below them.
When you come to the U.S., pretty early on, you realize that black is the absolute worst thing to be in the U.S., and you want to put as much distance between yourself and that as possible.
And that's exactly what this country tries to make people believe.
I think the African Americans are the most despised race in America, the most despised group in America. Why? First of all, we are illegal. That's the first thing. You can't put us out of here. Now, you might jail us, but you can't send us anywhere. We're here to stay. Five, six generations after slavery, we are here to stay.
Because we were taken as prisoners of war from other parts of Africa and brought and dispersed throughout what we call the diaspora, we're not a natural people. We're not a normal people. We're a made people.
So when you come here and you see people in this land of opportunity, in this land of great wealth, who have lived here for hundreds of years and who live in abject poverty in communities where there's widespread violence and things like that, you think there must be something wrong with them. They're doing this. They're at fault.
If you put a group 100 yards behind and tell them they can't run, and then you blow the whistle and everybody starts running, and then suddenly, halfway through the race, you say, start running. Oh, by the way, you don't have no shoes, not our problem. By the way, you sick, not our problem. And so what you have is accumulative disadvantages that gets passed down generation after generation.
You don't know, you have no idea what the background to that is. You have no idea what the backstory is.
Past always has a bearing on today.
If you just look at how this country was set up, it was built on the backs of slaves.
Country was built on the backs of slave labor.
Our ancestors who were enslaved, were brought there, and we are the descendants of prisoners of war, okay? But we're actually property.
I'm an African that was kidnapped from Africa long before I was born, and I've been in slavery for the last 300-400 years. I've been robbed of every identity.
In order for that project to lead to a prosperous country that could then aspire to empire, they had to have labor to exploit totally. That is, they had to have a slaveholding society.
The ghost of slaves runs through this place. This is not an urban myth. This is a fact.
There you see one of the blocks where chains were hooked into the walls, and on this here apparatus here was a block.
The natural resources of white people are black people.
That's got us starving, hungry. We're losing our house, we're losing our children.
Racism exists. It's big time. They do it in very subtle ways.
Their desire for empire, for finding other people to lord it over and steal from.
We were enslaved, for God's sake. We were stolen and sold out of our mother continent and brought here to work for nothing. For hundreds of years, we were treated like the dirt beneath people's feet. Dogs are being treated better than us.
The African who was stolen from their land and brought to the Western world gave their lives for this new land and got very little, if anything, in return. Their story in the United States is one of various levels of repression and control. Though no stage was as blatant as slavery, many say the more subtle forms can be just as destructive. Endurance and strength in the face of chains, incarcerations, and assassinations have become the way for this people to deal with many bitter realities. This is the story of black people in the United States, of African descent, and their continued struggle for true emancipation more than 400 years after being brought to this land.
Oh, sheep, they know the road. Oh, sheep, they know the road. Young lamb must find the way. I'm taking you back to the 1960s when I was adamant that adults in this world didn't have a bit of common sense, and that Africans in the South had spent too long, far too long, in the historic tradition of bowing and bending. So along with my peers, the young people of the Deep South, we rose up.
Between 60 and 61, perhaps 25,000 students had gone to jail, wave after wave after wave, and thousands of youth poured out. A quarter of a million high school kids boycotted, and elementary school kids boycotted in October in New York City with Milton Glamison, in Philadelphia, in Detroit. You know what I mean? A wave after wave after wave.
Too many black people seem to act as though they believed that the 1960s was about the, you know, the elimination of black institutions, you know, and I think that's a very wrong interpretation. I think people, from my perspective, always say that the 1960s was about choice. I like sitting on the back of the bus, but I don't want you to tell me that I have to sit back there.
Dr. King did psychological judo on white America. How? For the races, especially. He was able to do psychological judo by using the Bible on the one hand and the Constitution on the other, and he did.
There were discussions within the Pentagon and the military forces and the military intelligence agencies about him and about what they could do to counter his nonviolence, because it was really a game that they didn't understand. They don't understand love and community. They don't understand how things actually change from the heart. They were tremendously threatened and didn't know how to come up with an adequate way to do something about him. And of course, he had developed many of his ideas and techniques from Mahatma Gandhi, who also threatened the entire British Empire with what he was doing.
One day on the red hills of Georgia, sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners Will they be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood? I have a dream.
They freeze Dr. King on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in 1963, saying that he has a dream for integration. They don't want you to see Dr. King in 1968 and 1967, a year to the day before he died, speaking about ending the war in Vietnam and the militarization and the Poor People's March that he was organizing and the reasons that actually got him killed.
He gave a speech, the speech that got him killed. He said, "There comes a time when silence is betrayal. I must speak. Because if I do not speak now, I can never, ever again speak to angry young black men."
The time has come for America to hear the truth about this tragic war. Now, I've chosen to preach about the war in Vietnam today because I agree with Dante that the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who, in a period of moral crisis, maintain their neutrality. There comes a time when silence is betrayal.
Martin Luther King made a speech right before he was assassinated, saying he was coming to Washington to gain reparations.
Probably the strongest speech on reparation in the history of the movement in this country, where he says that America has issued us a bad check, and we've come to collect on that debt.
Of course, that terminated with his termination.
The assassination of Dr. King was implemented also by police and security forces who pulled out. People that normally were surveilling and guarding King were pulled off their jobs that day, inexplicably. So King was left in the open, and when he came out onto the balcony, it was easy to target him up there for these forces that were ready to kill him. And I think that part of the reason that Malcolm was assassinated and the timing was that he had met with Dr. King and they were talking about working together on the poverty issue.
In the 60s, Malcolm and Martin Luther King had different approaches to achieving freedom, justice, and equality, but they both agreed that that was the objective.
Malcolm X wanted to force Americans on human rights. American intellectuals and politicians don't want to go that way.
We accept Malcolm's challenge to raise the struggle in this country from a civil rights movement to a human rights movement.
Why the American government assassinated Brother Malcolm was, as Malcolm took our civil rights issue, made it a human rights issue, and talked about, in order for there to be substantive change, we cannot rely on the civil process, on the American judicial process. We have to take this to the world court.
Is by internationalizing the problem and putting it at a level where it can be taken into the United Nations, and then all of the other independent nations on this earth can involve themselves in our struggle and support us. And the only way by which this can be done, instead of it being called civil rights in the future, we're going to have to label it a human rights struggle, or the struggle for human rights.
The way he would say the word Negro was such scorn, he would always say the so-called Negro. And the way he said it was such scorn, that he, more than any other single individual, he was the one who helped change that and made, you know, get rid of that word, Negro.
I think that these murders were meant to kill hope within those communities.
The FBI and the COINTEL program, Army intelligence and what have you, had become so effective in destroying the movement of Mark Clark, Fred Hampton in Chicago.
So within a 10-year period, a lot of assassinations took place. You had Malcolm X, Medgar Evers, you had George Jackson, Jonathan Jackson, Assata Shakur in exile. They assassinated their own president. So this is what happened.
The real leaders were assassinated. We were decapitated as a people.
Well, that's common. Any system will assassinate the leaders, kill the head, and the snake will die. That's the way they feel about it.
At a time when they killed leadership, beginning with Medgar, Martin, Malcolm, they knocked off the leadership so we don't have those old heads to lean back on.
Even if you ask the average person my age today what was happening 20 years ago or 40 years ago, they really don't know what took place 20 or 40 years ago. And if they don't know what took place 20, 40 years ago, then they don't know what's going on now. And if they don't know what's going on now, then who's determining the future?
When we look at Dr. Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, so many who came before us, when they challenged the concept of democracy and the sovereignty of this country to enjoy its democracy while abusing and violating.
You have to make your, I guess you have to make your pact with God. Only that individual can determine that they're willing to go on a route and have to, if they're someone who's a spiritual person, I think there's a certain level of spirituality that has to be part of that process. You could not be a leader without being spiritual. Whatever God, whatever your name of your God is. And that person has to be deeply committed to their own sense of spirituality, their own sense of self, that what they're arguing for is greater than them. And we live in a capitalistic society where everything is very individualistic. No one thinks that anything is greater than them. It's about me. I gotta think about me first. As long as I can get what I need to get, I'll worry about you and everyone else later. But that's the problem with capitalism. And maybe at the heart of it all, capitalism is the problem.
I believe that the Islam religion is the best religion for our people because it creates unity and it gives one dignity and racial confidence and all of these things that are necessary to make a complete human being.
Are you not perhaps afraid of what might happen to you as a result of making these revelations?
Oh, yes. I probably am a dead man already.
We're key, and especially African-American Muslims, we're key because we understand the history of the United States from slavery all the way through. And we can't be put in that position again. I think a lot of people are afraid to stand up, to even protest, because of what they see that can be done as far as incarceration, as far as just being killed. I would say that number one, as a Muslim, you know, we fear Allah, and that's the only one that that's the only thing. We fear Allah. There is nothing. And I think my husband has said it over and over again. He's even written, you know, you can take my life, but you can't take my soul.